tuning in to the Postmodern Realities Podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's January 2022, and this is episode 271, which is a spoiler-filled conversation about the Marvel film Spider-Man No Way Home. Today's guest is Cole Burgett, who is a recent seminary graduate. He is also a graduate of the Moody Bible Institute and an author for the website Christ and Pop Culture. Cole has written an online exclusive film review for the Christian Research Journal. His review is called Spider-Man No Way Home and the Emotional Cheapening of the Modern Blockbuster. Our subscribers can read his review for free at our website, equip.org. And if you do not already subscribe and would like to gain access to our online exclusive content, please go to our website, equip.org, to subscribe. Cole, it's good to have you on.
Always good to be here. Thank you.
Spider-Man No Way Home is the newest Marvel film, and it's continuing to break box office records. In fact, I noticed that it has grossed more than $1.5 billion worldwide, which actually makes it one of the top 10 highest grossing films of all time. And what's interesting about that is it's become the first pandemic era movie to cross this $1 billion threshold. That means it's even catching up to some of the numbers for Avengers Infinity War, which is pretty interesting considering that most films post-pandemic theater shutting have really been tanking. And in addition to that, it's also been a success critically and, you know, critically acclaimed not only with film reviewers, but also with fans. But of course, not everyone listening to this podcast is a Marvel fan. And when I saw the film, besides the animated one, was the way back when Tobey Maguire Spider-Man. So I really have not kept up with it. I never saw the Andrew Garfield incarnation of Spider-Man. So before we talk about this particular film that's breaking all these box office records, can you give us some backstory on Spider-Man, the character itself? And of course, this is going to be a spoiler-filled review, as I just said, but the concept of the multiverse, because I did think that that was introduced when they did the animated Spider-Man film. And so is this concept of the multiverse, is it in the comics themselves?
Sure. So a little bit of background as we get into this. Spider-Man is one of the most popular superheroes going right now and has for a long time really been the face of Marvel Comics. The character was created in the early 1960s by a legendary comic book editor Stan Lee and his frequent co-creator Steve Ditko. And he's often cited as Stan Lee's favorite creation. And the character has proven to be very popular with both critics and audiences alike. I mean, of all the Marvel superheroes, none of them really even come close to having the sort of now iconic and modern mythological origin stories that, you know, characters like, say, Batman or Superman have, right? I mean, everybody and their brother knows that a spaceship crashing in Kansas is Superman. Two wealthy people gunned down in a dark alley and expensive pearls falling into the gutter is Batman. So even your more popular Marvel superheroes right now, save for maybe the Hulk, doesn't have that kind of power over the public imagination except for Spider-Man. Bitten by a radioactive spider, Uncle Ben gets killed, with great power comes great responsibility, and suddenly we're in tights and swinging through New York City. People just know that story. There's something very archetypal about it. There's a sense of modern mythology about it that's very important. And it's important to also note that over the years, Spider-Man has proven to be a very malleable character. Ever since the early 1990s, there have been different versions of Spider-Man. You have Miguel O'Hara, who's that guy? nobody knows who he is. He's actually going to be voiced by Oscar Isaac in the next animated Spider-Man movie. So look for that version of the character to become popular. And then you also have the now popular Miles Morales version of the character who was in the animated film that you mentioned. Into the Spider-Verse, I believe that was called. So the character has always been malleable in that sense. In an interview he gave, for the life of me, I cannot remember where I saw this, but in an interview Stan Lee is giving, he says that the best thing they did with Spider-Man was actually sort of unintentional, which was to give him a costume that completely covered his face. In other words, he's very unlike Batman or Superman in that any kid could look at Spider-Man and picture himself or herself being under the mask. Spider-Man really could be anybody. And that has played into the likability and everyman status of the character from the very beginning. And even Stanley recognized that. You can just as easily swap out Peter Parker for Miles Morales, and the basic hero profile remains the same. Now, as far as the multiverse idea, yeah, it's in the comics and it's been there for a few years now. So let me just try to explain this as simply as I can. When you have characters that have been around for 40 years, with multiple writers having told stories about them, eventually readers, especially readers who grew up with the character, are going to start asking logical questions. For example, why in 40 years has this character not aged? Or didn't this thing that happened contradict something that happened, you know, 25 years ago under a different writer? Now, rather than just tell people, look at storytelling with multiple creative teams across a large span of time, there's bound to be some discrepancies. A lot of comic book creators do what they do best and begin coming up with explanations for why there are apparent discrepancies in the material. Well, maybe it all happens. The differences are just in different universes. That becomes the solution and the basis of the multiverse. So with Spider-Man, for example, there's the Peter Parker of what's called the Marvel Ultimate Universe, who is not the same as the Peter Parker from the 1962 comics. So there are parallel universes in a sense, and all of those parallel universes together are referred to as the multiverse. It's really just a way of maintaining continuity. Eventually, some writers come along and look for ways of exploiting that to bring different characters together in new ways. And that's what this new film, No Way Home, does for the cinematic Spider-Man. So, you know, you mentioned the Tobey Maguire films. Well, those films come back into play in this one, and so does Tobey Maguire himself, and the same with Andrew Garfield and those Spider-Man films.
Well, you know, it's breaking all these box office records. So this film is hugely popular with audiences right now. And it can't just be, you know, the fanboys, the teenage boys, because the fact that it's cracked $1.5 billion worldwide means not just Americans or Western folks are connecting with Spider-Man. So why do you think that is? Do you think it's because he has this teenage alter ego and, you know, like Bruce Wayne seems like people couldn't relate to him. He's this very uber wealthy guy. But, you know, Peter Parker could have been any of us, you know, any nerd kid in high school that people didn't like or whatever it was. Do you think it's his alter ego that's resonating with people?
Oh, absolutely. I think that's a huge part of it. Spider-Man is very much an everyman. He's a superhero at the end of the day, but his general persona is that he's an everyman. He's very likable, very relatable in that sense. And that is, those are the kinds of characters that Stan Lee excelled at creating and did just tremendous work differentiating Marvel as a brand from DC, where you really had these timeless sort of almost mythological archetypes. You know, Superman is Zeus as to, you know, Batman is to Hades, something like that. Stan Lee did a very good job of grounding his superheroes. And that's what Marvel does very, very good with, is grounding their superheroes and making them relatable. And Spider-Man has always been very popular with audiences, even as far back as the early 2000s. Those films that Sam Raimi did with Tobey Maguire that we mentioned, the first two movies of that trilogy especially, are considered two of the greatest superhero films ever made that really helped redefine the modern film genre. I mean, even as a kid, I remember people I knew who didn't really watch those kinds of movies watching and really enjoying those Spider-Man films. We have to remember that Spider-Man as a character has been popular with audiences for a long time now. As far as the current film, the obvious draw is the chance to see some of those previous iterations of Spider-Man show up again. So you're pulling from a few different target audiences. You're not just pulling from a younger crowd. You're pulling the interests of people who watched the Sam Raimi films or watched the films with Andrew Garfield. And of course, this film has two of the biggest, if not the biggest, young stars right now. Tom Holland and the girl with the dramatic one name like Madonna. I can never remember her name. What is her
Zendaya.
Name?
Zendaya.
That's it. Thank you. Her. Yeah. I mean, she was just in Dune as well. So she's really a rising power in Hollywood. You've also got all the Marvel fans who will show up because it continues the cinematic universe. So there are lots of different audiences being targeted here, usually younger, sure, but they're pulling into this film. And it's a film that a lot of parents will take their kids to see. So all that taken together, you know, I'm not surprised this film is doing well. It's a theater exclusive film. There's practically nothing out right now that is a theater exclusive or to compete with. So I'm not surprised it's doing well.
In your review for us of this film and in other podcast interviews we've done, you've talked a little bit about sentimentality. Can you define this for us? I mean, how do you see that this film is sentimental? Not, I guess, in a way that's kind of remembering fondly the past, but more of a, you know, in a maudlin type of way. Is that how you see the sentimentality?
Yeah. So let me cushion how I get into these details. Usually I'm a very forgiving film goer. If there's a film that critics and audiences, you know, savage right out of the gate, I usually will watch the film and try to see the director's intentions and the writer's intentions, and will very often go to bat for the finished product. It is very rare that I come across a film that does incredibly well that I walk away from genuinely disliking. I can think something isn't all it's cracked up to be, sure, and I can usually tell when I'm not going to like something based on a trailer, but it's rare that I see a film that is wildly popular that I just think has serious problems. This is where the gatekeepers tar and feather me. But this film, Spider-Man No Way Home, is kind of one of those films for me. Let me just get into the guts of this for a second. So I've only seen the film once, and I'm sure there are some small details I've missed. So I'm not really being very nitpicky about the mechanics of the multiverse or anything like that. Even though I thought there were some gaps in logic, that just comes with the territory, right? It's science fiction, you know, you get over it. The ending, even, which made very little sense to me, I can overlook because, again, it's a movie. But the thing that really started to bother me, that I didn't realize was bothering me until a couple of days after seeing it, is the narrative itself and the approach of the writers toward the film's message. So let me step back and set the stage for just a second. Personally, I think the most important thing a filmmaker can do is create and maintain a consistency of tone throughout a film. It is actually harder and requires far greater skill on the part of the filmmaker to create and manage a consistent tone throughout a movie than it is to have a hodgepodge of tones. And I've often pointed out, you know, Marvel films as a whole play fast and loose with tone. One second you're laughing, the next you're not sure if you're supposed to cry, and then you don't really want to invest that much because you know you're going to be laughing again a minute later. That's not to say a skilled filmmaker can't manipulate tone to great effect, but by and large, a consistent tone, whether it's playful or serious, is much harder to maintain. And it's much harder to maintain in an age of market-ready cinema. And this is where a lot of the self-aware storytelling really comes out in the herky-jerky back and forth of tone. And Disney has made a lot of money out of Marvel properties by having lots of wisecracks in their films at the expense of tonal consistency. Now, why do I say any of that? Because the first major indicator for me that something was off in this film came with the death of May Parker. Spider-Man has lost a lot of people, but, you know, Aunt May is the constant. And this film contains, by far, the most brutally violent death for one of Peter's guardian figures. I mean, she isn't shot. She's impaled through the back and sort of knocked all over the place. It's really violent. And we jump from that scene to the introduction of Tobey Maguire and Andrew Garfield, the two Spider-Men from previous films. And despite the fact that they're suddenly trapped in this supposedly strange world, there's no struggle with them. They're quipping and talking, you know, unlike they've ever talked in their own respective films. And it just feels very off from an emotional standpoint. And so I was a little begrudging of the narrative for expecting me to take something like May's death so seriously in a narrative that was just not interested in going through other serious emotional beats. But as I thought more about it, the events that led to May's death are really what turned me off from this film. See, the whole conceit of the movie is that Peter inadvertently opens up a portal that brings all of these previous villains from other Spider-Man films into his universe. So he's suddenly fighting characters that Tobey Maguire and Andrew Garfield fought years ago. But after stopping them, he decides that he's going to cure them. Now, this is a noble idea, and I don't fault the film at all for this. He decides he's going to help them before sending them back to their own universes, because the way the film skins it, Spider-Man basically had to kill them in their own universes in the previous films, which isn't entirely true. But this is where the sentimentality of the whole thing comes in so palpably. Because all of these villains are cured with just a little technology. In other words, none of these characters are true villains. They are just misguided. And of course, Peter underestimates the Green Goblin, played by Willem Dafoe, as he was back in the 2002 Sam Raimi Spider-Man film. Great actor, great role, really steals the show. And his underestimating that character is what gets May killed. But even then, he's cured with just an injection at the end of the movie. You know, after seeing the film, I just thought that's really just a trite approach to storytelling. It's a movie that is absolutely terrified of complexity. The far more interesting and honestly realistic thing would be to have a villain who chooses to be evil, despite all of the help Spider-Man offers. And it looked for a minute like the narrative was going to go in that direction. You know, that was May's very powerful final statement to Peter, that despite the fact she's dying, he still did the right thing trying to help these villains. And, you know, I work with real criminals for a day job, right? I rehabilitate everything from small-time thieves to murderers. And I can tell you, you can't help someone who doesn't want it. Some people just like to do bad things, and you can't airbrush over that. And this film certainly does exactly that. And that's the sentimental part of it. Sentimentality is, we can define it as a disease of feeling that is incapable of dealing with irresolution or emotional complexity. So it's emotionalism on the cheap. It's the curing of Norman Osborn without ever forcing Norman Osborn to reckon with the fact that he's murdered May Parker, among others. And in a culture of excess, in a culture where thoughts must be packaged in 240 characters or less, this inability to maintain a consistent, serious tone through serious moments, coupled with this cheap emotionalism, you know, I really think is just a testament to where we are as a people. So hopefully that threads everything together well enough.
On episode 269, two episodes ago, you heard me spin a wheel of randomizing all of the entries that we had for free subscription to the Christian Research Journal. The winner was Stu Perrin, and we have not heard from Stu yet. So Stu, you have till the end of January. We'll give you 1 month to contact us as the winner of the prize for the free subscription to the Christian Research Journal, which you can give to yourself, extend your subscription, or give to a friend or your pastor, perhaps a missionary. And if Stu does not contact us by that time, I will spin the wheel again and pick a different winner. And that is, again, by the end of January. Now, be on the lookout, because this year we're going to have two more giveaways, and I will make an announcement in the next few episodes to let you know what the next giveaway is. Now, of course, part of the swag that the giveaway will have is a free subscription to the Christian Research Journal, but it'll have a little bit more swag this time, and so you won't want to miss out on listening for our next giveaway and helping us out by giving us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts. Now, we do want to thank you for all the ways in which you support this podcast. Simply telling friends about it is a great way, and also any of your favorite episodes, if you want to link to those, on your social media accounts. If you're not on social media, it's really easy. You can just go to wherever you get your podcasts and copy the link to your favorite episodes and just text that to a friend or email it to a friend. Let them know about this content. And we'd be very thankful for that. The other way, of course, is to subscribe to our journal. Now, the great thing about our subscription for $33.50 is not only do you get print edition issues of the journal straight to your doorstep in your mailbox, but you also get access to all of our online free articles just for subscribers. Now, of course, the Journal has been around for more than 42 years. I don't know if you know that, but we've been around for a very long time. And we literally have more than 1,000 articles for free on our website, not under a paywall. But we really think it's important to pay our writers and remunerate them for all this great content that we do. And of course, we have a budget to get our subscriptions to your door. And so we ask that you help us out and support us by subscribing. Now, we just also are thankful for you for any support you can give us. It might not be that a subscription's in your budget, so we'd be grateful for a tip. If you want to tip us for this content, you can easily do that at our website, equip.org. Go to magazine at the drop-down, Postmodern Realities. Any landing page for any episode has a link where you could give us a tip. Maybe something as small as $3, $5, $10, something like that, that you would be able to help us out and be able to help us give you this free content, which we're coming up on 300 episodes, which is a lot of content that we've been doing this podcast for the last 6 years. And we want to continue bringing all these very thoughtful and provocative interviews that we have with our journal writers just to you. So thank you for supporting the Christian Research Journal. You know, we're just talking about storytelling, and years ago, we published an article about storytelling as subversive apologetics. In other words, that movies from Hollywood can be used as avenues to talk about spiritual things for evangelism and also for apologetics. So some, you know, you're talking about the storytelling in this film. Some critics see this film as very powerful. So almost some Christian critics have seen it almost like that subversive apologetics. In other words, for some Christian reviewers, Spider-Man No Way Home is really about hope and redemption even for some of these most evil nemeses that Spider-Man has faced over his career. And one Christian reviewer even compared this film as having beats like Lord of the Rings, which I don't know that I would go as far as to say that. But why do you not see this film? You're seeing a sentimental, not in this large scope, as some Christians would say, wow, this is a really almost a subversive apologetic in terms of hope and redemption and restoration by some of these evil characters who are restored.
Because you just don't see that. The character who really, you know, suffers as always is Peter with the death of May. But even then, it's sort of the irony of the narrative. He underestimates the goblin, but at the end of the day, the goblin is still cured just as easily as if he hadn't been. There's sort of a dissonance there that just didn't work for me personally. And I can understand the desire to see the redemption of the villains. I think that's noble, and I think it's an interesting storytelling approach to it. My issue is not that we're trying to redeem villains. My issue is that the villains are redeemed on the cheap. There is absolutely zero struggle with any of this. There is no reckoning, to my knowledge, having only seen the film once, but there is not a scene where any of these villains come to terms with what they've done, whether or not it was their choice or not. Closest you'll get is, you know, a very quiet scene at the end with Norman Osborn after he's been cured. I think a more interesting thing to have done would have been them to try to cure him and then it not work, and then have to suddenly deal with the fact that this guy is just evil. He likes it. He chooses it. You know, I wish it were just as simple as sticking a needle in somebody's neck and making them good. I wish it was just as simple as, you know, tweaking the rogue technology on the back of the dude's neck that would make him good again. But it's not. Reality is it's not that simple. I was kind of left baffled at the end when all of the villains, all of them, were rehabilitated with just a little advanced technology. And I think it really gets to is a discrepancy in how we view evil and wrong in the world. Evil is not something that arises from within. According to, you know, this film's narrative, it is something that is done to someone that has to then be fixed. And their default baseline setting is that they would be good people. Missing the fact that in Sam Raimi's film, the original Spider-Man film, the reason Norman Osborn is exposed to the mind-altering chemicals in the first place is because he's ambitious. And he's basically playing a political game within his company because he doesn't want to get ousted. And he pushes too far. He's much more like a Dr. Frankenstein, Sam Raimi's film, than in this one. So again, it's not that I have an issue with the redeeming of the villains at all. It's that some are not so easily redeemed. You know, if we want to make the comparison to The Lord of the Rings, let's not forget what happens to Gollum in that story. Someone who is just so thoroughly corrupted that he can't not lose his life in pursuit of power. So, you know, we have to be very careful that something that looks superficially good is actually reinforcing something that is truly good.
You've touched on sentimentality before as something that affects Christians too. And also you've talked about how it affects the broader culture. And, you know, you just mentioned that in this particular film, it seems to be that these villains are kind of redeemed on the cheap. It's just almost, there's just not even a repentance involved. It's just, oh, suddenly they go from one thing to another thing. So do you think that this kind of sentimentality is something that affects the Christian church? I mean, is that something that we struggle with not grappling with, like you were just talking about, Gollum, the true sin or corruption that somebody might have?
Oh, absolutely. I think we've talked about this in different places on this podcast before. And I think I mentioned that theologian Stan Hauerwas said in an interview published on Duke University's YouTube channel that the biggest challenge facing the church today is sentimentality. I wish that we could produce interesting atheists, but we're not strong enough believers to produce interesting atheists. In other words, the sentimental drivel that has no basis in reality, that is so often spouted from a pulpit on Sunday morning, makes it easy for an atheist to not believe. And we present no real challenge for them. And we're not talking intellectually here. No. We've got the intellectual basis covered. We really are a bunch of intellectual churchgoers with our commentaries and small group books that quote the professors. I am talking from an emotional standpoint. There's a very good book I'm going to recommend here. And let me go ahead and warn you that it contains very strong language and that it is done intentionally and with a brilliant purpose. And if that offends you, then just don't read it. It's that simple. But the book is called Unapologetic: Why, Despite Everything, Christianity Can Still Make Surprising Emotional Sense. And the writer is Francis Spufford, S-P-U-F-F-O-R-D. This book makes a very good case for Christianity purely on the basis of experiencing complex emotions in a world of sentimentality, of the cheapening of emotions. And as much as it takes the new atheist movement to task, it also skewers the mindset of a lot of modern churches. Jeremy Begbie, in his essay, Beauty, Sentimentality, and the Arts, outlines three things that sentimentality does. One, it evades or trivializes evil, which, case in point, is exactly what No Way Home does with its villains. Two, it is emotionally self-indulgent, which is also exactly how No Way Home treats the returning Spider-Man. And three, it fails to take appropriate, costly action. None of these villains have to pay for the people they've hurt or killed. In fact, none of it would have happened anyway had there just been some advanced technology and better education on how to use it. It's really a very cynical way of telling a story. And sentimentality, to the point of your question, absolutely infects the church. Sermons that are eaten up with cheap cliches because the preacher fails to deal honestly with evil. I mean, I just sat through one of these sermons a few Sundays ago. For anyone interested in reading more on this topic specifically, I would point you toward the preacher and writer John Kessler, K-O-E-S-S-L-E-R. He has an article online entitled Sentimentality and Preaching that deals with this topic quite well. So, I do think it's an issue in the church today.
Some people would just say, well, No Way Home is not trying to be some kind of gritty, you know, overly realistic film. It's just one of those popcorn superhero type of films. So would you say that with this film, it's kind of an example of where we are as a culture with being sentimental? Or can we just say, well, it's not trying to make a greater point, although some people have tried to say that it's making a greater point with redemption. Is it somehow representative of where we are as a culture, not really wanting to deal with things that are particularly evil, I guess, or thinking that they're easily redeemed.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Oscar Wilde once wrote, "A sentimentalist is simply one who wants to have the luxury of an emotion without paying for it. We think we can have our emotions for nothing. We cannot. Even the finest and most self-sacrificing emotions have to be paid for. Strangely enough, that is what makes them fine. The intellectual and emotional life of ordinary people is a very contemptible affair. Just as they borrow their ideas from a sort of circulating library of thought, the zeitgeist of an age that has no soul, and send them back soiled at the end of each week, so they always try to get their emotions on credit and refuse to pay the bill when it comes in." If we accept Wilde's premise that the zeitgeist of an age that has no soul is this repeating circularity of thought that keeps getting stripped of any meaning and sent back. I mean, we live in the age of reboots. We have been telling the same stories over and over for the past 20 years. How many times have we watched Uncle Ben and Aunt May die? How many times have we had to watch Martha's pearls scatter across Crime Alley? I mean, for all of the progress that we talk about making, we are a culture that is imaginatively and literarily stuck, and even a little juvenile in our thinking. And, you know, to your point, a film like Spider-Man No Way Home puts that on full display. And the fact that it has raked in so much money is evidence of that. I don't think it's any stretch of the imagination to say that for the past 50, 60 years, if not longer, we have been in a very slow process of redefining evil and what it is. And in some ways, No Way Home represents the zenith of that. It's a very good example of it. So yeah, I think this film is one of the best artifacts of the current cultural zeitgeist, for sure.
Wouldn't you say that some people feel like the world is a really terrifying, evil place? If you're doom scrolling on your phone, just one thing after another. And so don't you think that as part of these films, there's a sense of expected optimism or perhaps comfort? We find comfort in seeing the same story over and over again because that helps us take our mind off of evil in the world. And so don't you think that people would expect these stories to be optimistic and sentimental because of that?
Oh, of course it is. But optimism is not sentimentality, and therein lies the difference. And the confusion of the two is very often what leads to pervasive sentimentalism. Optimism is a general disposition characterized by hopefulness. Sentimentality is the thing that is going to trade on that hope to elicit a cheap emotional response. Let me spin it to you this way. You know, surprise. I'm often accused of being a pessimist, you know, which I think is kind of outlandish considering the fact that I believe in something called resurrection. When I die, I don't stay dead. I believe that. You know, if there's a trump card for an optimist, I feel like that's it. I might die, but I don't stay dead. The sentimentalist is the person who will come in and say, okay, but let's not talk about death. It's a refusal to acknowledge that before you can have a resurrection, death must first come. And it's not easy, and it's not meant to be easy. But for the one who stands on the basis of imputed righteousness, who is of Christ, who has conquered hell and the grave, there's something better than hope waiting on the other side. But you can't have one without the other. Now, having said that, do people expect Spider-Man stories to be sentimental? Probably. Should they? No, not at all. Because when you go back to the comic books, Peter Parker is a character who is very accustomed to death. And failure is part and parcel to his heroic journey. That is one of the things that has made him such a relatable character and so much of an everyman, is that he can fail. He can really mess up and misread situations. Ben Parker, Gwen Stacy, the list goes on. See, what makes the comic book incarnation of Spider-Man so strong a character is his optimism, not his sentimentalism. And that's part of the drama of the narrative, part of the cost of being a heroic figure. He has lost some of the most important people in his life to villains, and he grows and matures in that. None of this painting in monotones that this film does, where Peter goes from curing Norman to wanting to kill him to curing him again. There's a very complex emotional framework. Go back and look at the ending of the original Spider-Man in 2002, where Norman is killed. This current film makes it out to seem like these previous versions of Peter Parker killed their villains, and that's just not true. Norman killed himself. Peter couldn't save him because Norman didn't want to be saved. No Way Home comes along and says, well, if Peter had just had time to make a cure, none of this would have happened. And even after Norman kills May, everyone just sort of treats it like it never happened. You get, you know, maybe a couple beats of Norman looking relieved and haunted in the end, and then he just disappears into a beam of light. Now, sure, Spider-Man is an optimistic character, but he's not an idiot, and he's certainly not a sentimentalist. Persevering, choosing to be the hero, is what he does best. And see, that's really what suffers in the end, isn't it? No Way Home's big assertion is that all villains can be saved if you just care enough to cure them of whatever outside factors make them do bad things, from voices in their head to rogue technology. It robs any sense of choice from evil. And the flip side to that coin is that it robs any sense of choice from goodness. Because goodness is suddenly a default setting. It is not something that requires daily sacrifice. Norman would have been a good man if he just had a cure. No mention of the fact that in the 2002 film, he was actually ambitious. And ambition is what drove him to become exposed to the mind-altering substance. If goodness is the default setting, then Spider-Man isn't a hero. He's just another guy in a mask. And while he's certainly an everyman, what makes him exceptional and heroic is the fact that with great power comes great responsibility. In other words, because he is unlike everyone else in power, he has a greater responsibility in the choices he makes and how he exercises that power. For a film that actually uses that quote very effectively from Aunt May, it really seems to miss the point of it quite profoundly. That's just my take.
Well, a few minutes ago, you mentioned the 2002 Spider-Man film. So for our listeners out there, obviously, you were not a fan of this film. But what are some of the best Spider-Man stories out there, or other Spider-Man films you recommend seeing to get a different take on how the character is portrayed?
I think I mentioned the first two Sam Raimi Spider-Man films are considered classics of the genre. I mean, these were movies that were done, you know, before Chris Nolan did the Batman stuff. They're really very good, and they're very optimistic films, but they're complex in all the right ways. Very well received, very good movies. I would definitely say check those out. And, you know, this is another one they'll tar and feather me for, but The Amazing Spider-Man, the first Andrew Garfield Spider-Man movie, I think that was 2014. Don't quote me on that. I actually liked that movie. I really like Andrew Garfield's take on the character. He's very different, and Andrew Garfield's just a really good actor. But it has Emma Stone in it as Gwen Stacy, who's very different from Mary Jane. So it's just different. It's very different. The villain is sort of like a giant CGI lizard. It's nonsense. The acting is really good, and I enjoyed the film. And then the other film, which you mentioned, the animated one, Into the Spider-Verse. You said you saw that one, right?
I did see that one. Yeah.
Yeah. I really liked that one. I was surprised. I was working with kids at the time. They really gravitated toward it. Minorities, especially, really gravitated toward it. And it was a very good film. I enjoyed it. And that film certainly became the basis, a lot of what this film does with the multiverse and that kind of stuff. I really liked it. I thought that was a good film, and I enjoyed it. So I would recommend those. I think the first one that Tom Holland did, was that called Homecoming? I think it was. The one with Michael Keaton as the villain. I actually liked that. I thought that was a very good film. Again, just a different take on the character. So I think those are good films to check out for different takes on Spider-Man that are actually quite good. To backtrack for just a second, the Amazing Spider-Man film that came out in 2014, I know it's sort of remembered as being goofy. But if you go back and look at the reviews when that film came out, it actually did quite well. It got a lot of good critical marks. So there's that. As far as actual comic books and stories go, goodness, there are so many with Spider-Man. There's a really good arc called Spider-Man Death of the Stacies that shows that failure has always been a part of Peter's heroic journey. Not everyone can be saved, unfortunately, but Peter finds a way to press on despite that. That's a very good series of stories. It deals with the death of Captain Stacy and the death of Gwen Stacy. Those are very good reads. There's another storyline by Stan Lee called Spider-Man No More that is also really tremendous, with art by John Romita Sr. There's the original Hobgoblin saga that sort of gives a different take on the goblin stuff in the comics. And then there's a storyline called Kraven's Last Hunt. Kraven is a character who will eventually make it to the movies. I'm sure of it. He's very, very popular. And then Jeff Loeb and Tim Sale did a comic book called Spider-Man Blue that is just out of this world. Anything by Loeb and Sale, who did The Long Halloween, the Batman story, The Long Halloween, is usually a safe bet. And they did a book called Spider-Man Blue. So those would be my recommendations for people to check out.
And I will note The Amazing Spider-Man came out in 2012, and the sequel to that one came out in 2014.
14, so
well, finally, I have, 2012 for the original one with Andrew Garfield and Emma Stone, and then the follow-up was 2014. Well, finally, I have some fun rapid-fire questions for Cole for our listeners to get to know our writers better. So for DC and Marvel, do you prefer comic books or films?
I will take Marvel films over DC films generally. Specific ones, not the case. But for comics, definitely DC.
And so this is a new year. It's January. Do you have any resolutions about reading more books or watching more films?
Not watching more films. There are some books I definitely want to read, and a lot of articles I want to get through as well. So yeah, I'm going to be doing a lot of reading this year.
Well, thanks, Cole, for once again being a guest on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to episode 271, which has been a conversation with journal author Cole Burgett about his review of the new Marvel film, Spider-Man No Way Home. Cole's article is available to read for free for our subscribers at our website, equip.org. His review is called Spider-Man No Way Home and the Emotional Cheapening of the Modern Blockbuster. If you'd like to read his review and you don't already subscribe to our journal, please go to our website, equip.org, to subscribe.